Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. My co-hosts today are criminal courts reporter Sarah Mervosh.
Hey, Tristan.
And criminal justice reporter extraordinaire Jen Emily.
Hello.
On today's episode, we're talking about a little news in the past week in the death penalty. Kevin Krause, our federal courts reporter, will also join us by phone in Austin. He is currently down there covering the trial of a woman associated with the corruption case against Dallas County Commissioner John Wiley Price. That's a big one. We'll also be joined by our guest today, Ray Jackson. He's an attorney here in Dallas who wrote a novel about crime called Lone Justice. We're excited for that one. And Dallas Morning News editorial writer Mike Hashimoto will end our show today with his thoughts about fantasy sports. It's a segment called Hashing It Out. You won't want to miss that. Here's what else you might have missed this week, though. A suspect in the sexual assault of a child was charged with two rapes this week. Dallas police said Latorian DeSheik Williams was responsible for attacks on women in 2014 and 2015. Both the women were walking alone at night in Lake Highlands when Williams allegedly drove up to them and had them get in his car. One woman reported the attack to police immediately, and DNA came back as a match to Williams earlier this month. The other's description of the suspect also matched his MO and his description, gold teeth, for instance. He remains in Dallas County Jail. His bail is set at $300,000. And speaking of arrest, Dallas police announced the arrest of 29-year-old Ernest Scruggs in connection with the death of his aunt, Georgia Scruggs. She was a hairdresser and previously told friends that she feared her nephew was going to kill her. He allegedly admitted the crime. So he's in jail. Also speaking of jail, the former Marine corporal accused of killing a University of North Texas student in a Denton drive-by shooting on New Year's Eve is now back in Texas. He came back this morning, which is Thursday. 20-year-old Eric Jamal Johnson of Fort Worth was extradited from Arizona. He was arrested at a military base there. He admitted shooting the 20-year-old student on New Year's Eve, and his bond is set at $1 million. And speaking of extradition, Ethan Couch, also known as the Affluenza Boy, could return to the U.S. in the next few weeks. He has been in Mexico since he was captured, which is in violation of his probation. We devoted an entire episode to the Ethan Couch saga since he killed four people while driving drunk in 2013 near Burleson. You can listen to that episode online or on iTunes. But that's enough about crime. Let's get to punishment. Last night, Texas executed a man for strangling a female impersonator in Houston in 2001. Sarah, I understand that there's another execution scheduled in the coming months that you know something about.
That's right. John Battaglia, he's on death row for killing his two daughters, Faith and Liberty. They were 9 and 6 when he shot them in the early 2000s. He's been on death row since then, since he was convicted of capital murder, and he is scheduled to die March 30th, and I am actually signed up to be a media witness, which is something us journalists get to do, whether that's a pleasure or a burden, I'm not sure. But it's something that's part of our job. And so I signed up to be a witness to that execution if it goes forward. He has lost his two most recent appeals, so it's looking like that's probably going to happen. Jen, you've covered the death penalty. You've helped you around when this case happened. Why was this case such a big deal?
It was a big deal because, you know, not only did a man kill his two daughters just after they'd been on the phone with his their mom and, you know, basically saying, why are you making daddy do this? And it was horrifying. It was heart-wrenching. The girl's mom lived in the Park Cities, and he lived in Deep Ellum at Adam Hat. So if you ever drive in Deep Ellum and you see that sort of black water tower looking thing that says Adam Hats, that's where it happened. I think about it every time I drive past.
It's probably a nice place to live otherwise.
Otherwise, yeah. Yes. I don't know who lives there now. I'm sure there's some perfectly nice people there. I was there the day John Battaglia got sentenced to death.
And I actually interviewed him in prison, I guess it was 2 years ago now. And he, you know, it had been more than a decade since this happened. And I tried to, it was for a series about domestic violence, and it was a story specifically about people who killed their loved ones. And I tried to get him to explain, you know, what happened? Why did you do this? And he wouldn't say whether he did it or not. He said, I feel like I didn't do it. But he basically avoided, you know, saying either way. But he did talk about his daughters. He said that he has a tattoo with their name and tattoo with roses that he got after the shooting. And he talked about having pictures in his cell of them. So let's hear a little bit from him now, from the interview, him talking about his two daughters.
The times you have with them, do you worry about where they are now?
No, I don't worry about where they are now. Why would I worry about where they are now?
Where do you think they are?
Where we all are. We're all here, all gone at the same time. I'm not worried about it. Nobody should be worried about it. People do, but that's people that have their own philosophies and their own way of dealing with existence.
So you can hear that sort of echo there. That's because he's behind a glass window, and we're talking over a phone. And, you know, you can also hear a little bit of exasperation in my voice because it was a long interview, and he spent a lot of time all over the place sort of getting angry and being aggressive about everyone who had wronged him, including the Dallas Morning News. And so I was trying to get him to basically acknowledge, you know, what actually happened and that, you know, didn't happen.
So, Jen, you've actually witnessed executions, multiple executions before. What is that like, and what can Sarah, I guess, expect?
The most I could say about it, the most surprising thing about watching someone die on a gurney like that is it's so medical. It's so sterile. It's like watching somebody go to sleep. That is the most surprising. It's not violent. There's a lot of debate about what the person feels as they're dying, and nobody knows. But to watch it, it's just you feel very removed. You're right there. You're watching through the glass. You're listening to the man or the woman's last words. And sometimes they say they're sorry. Sometimes they say nothing. Sometimes they're angry. There is a chaplain there with a Bible. And he usually puts his hand on the person's leg, and you just wait and you watch, and you sometimes they'll start snoring, their face might turn a little bit blue, and then they die.
And it's not just journalists in the gallery. The victims of the family or the family members of the victim are allowed to be there, as well as the offender's family.
There's two separate rooms, one for the family and the prosecutors. And the family of the victims and the prosecutors, and then the people who were there on behalf of the inmate, their attorneys, loved ones, or anybody who they wanted there or in the other room. So it's a highly emotional time, but there's a separation.
So I talked to John Battaglia's older daughter, his surviving daughter from a previous marriage, back when I wrote this story, and she had a lot of conflicting emotions about this. And you know, these were her half-sisters. They were her little sisters. She loved them. And it was really hard for her to, you know, but she also, he was also her dad. You know, that doesn't take away from that he was, you know, physically her dad. And so she was just really had a lot of mixed emotions. And I went back and looked at my notes when I saw that his execution had been scheduled to see, you know, what she had said. And she said then that she just had no interest in going. She said it was just so weird, like, you know, people have their family members die, but very few people know the set date that someone is going to die. Even if someone is terminally ill, you don't know exactly when. But so it was just very odd to her to know exactly when her dad is going to die. And I'm sure, you know, and she in a way is both a family member of the victim as well as the inmate. So that's what's make these domestic violent cases so interesting.
Yep. Very much like that. I watched the execution of George Rivas, who was the ringleader of the Texas Seven. Some prison escapees who killed an Irving police officer named Aubrey Hawkins. And I talked to his son right before the execution. Andrew was, I think, 9 when this happened, when his dad was murdered. And so he sort of grew up knowing what happened. And he just had a baby right before the execution. And he had no interest in going to the execution either. He just didn't really want to see it. He just knowing that it happened was enough. It wasn't something that he needed to see. He felt it would be weird. It wasn't, it wouldn't give him, you know, his dad back. It wouldn't be closure. Nothing could be closure.
Now joining us on the phone is Kevin Krause from Austin. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tristan.
Kevin, you're covering the trial of a woman accused of giving a bribe to, I guess, through a few people to a county commissioner for a contract. Could you tell us a little bit about that case?
Absolutely. It's a federal trial here in Austin. Helena Tantillo is accused of lying to the FBI about this payment she allegedly arranged for Dallas County Commissioner John Wally Price in 2004 to help her company at the time, Bearing Point, win a multi-million dollar contract to digitize county records. And today is the third day of the trial, and the defense just rested. They called only one witness who was Ms. Tantillo herself, and she testified for about 2 hours. In essence, she said that she did not know the purpose, or she did not know that this money was going to go to Kathy Neely and then to Price.
Kathy Neely being John Wiley Price's political consultant.
Exactly right. That's what the government is alleging, that Tantillo increased the pay of her consultant, Christian Campbell, for 2 months so that extra money could go to Kathy Neely, who was a consultant for Bearing Point, and then that Kathy Neely paid a portion of that money, ended up being $2,500, to Commissioner Price for his vote. And also that the government alleges that Price leaked internal county documents to Bearing Point through Kathy Neely.
And Kevin, Christian Campbell, who was arrested along with John Wiley Price, is now testifying for the government and is testifying in this trial. From what you're hearing, how damaging is his testimony to Commissioner Price?
Well, it could be potentially very damaging. He was charged along with Price and Neely and Price's assistant, Daphne Fain, in this bribery and tax evasion case. And he has pleaded guilty to a bribery charge. And in exchange for leniency in his sentence, he's agreed to testify against Commissioner Price when his trial begins in September. And he did show this week that he's a pretty good witness. He was subjected to cross-examination. He held up pretty well, was relaxed, confident, didn't stumble or stutter or seem like he was making things up. He seemed like he could do pretty well in September. However, Tantillo's defense attorney did point out to the jury that he has some issues in his past with telling the truth. He apparently fudged some expense reports to a client of his in the past. He agreed to this. He admits that he went along with this bribery scheme. The defense's point was that he's a liar and he's committed fraud in the past, and I assume that's what Commissioner Price's defense attorney will say also in September.
Kevin, this has been many, many years in the making, which is typically how federal cases work. I mean, some of these events that are alleged in the bribery scheme or happened in the mid-2000s, early 2000s. How are things looking for Commissioner Price now after all of the buildup of all of those years? The indictment comes down. Now we've got this this trial of an association, basically, that'll be a preview to his trial. Based on that, how are things looking for Commissioner Price?
Well, you know, I think we'll know pretty soon when the jury renders a verdict. If they do convict Tantillo, that would indicate that they believed Christian Campbell and that they believed he was a credible witness. And if so, that would bode well for the government and bad for John Wiley Price. And then conversely, if the jury votes to acquit Helena Tantillo, then that could signify problems with the government's case against Price because one of their key witnesses is Mr. Campbell.
Meanwhile, Commissioner Price is just, you know, he's still working. He's still commissioner's court on Tuesdays, and life is going on for him in the meantime.
Yeah, exactly. He has said from day one that it'll be business as usual for him, even after he was indicted criminally. And he is attending county meetings and doing what he does. He has an opponent who is running against him for his district, which he's held since the 1980s, Dwayne Carraway. Even despite all this legal trouble, he's expected to win because he's so popular in his district.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll definitely keep an eye on this case as it progresses and when the John Wiley Price case comes up in September.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Joining us in the studio is attorney Ray Jackson to talk about his new legal thriller novel, Lone Justice. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, you're an attorney, you have lots of cases, you're in court all the time. Why did you decide to write a book?
Because I wanted to get out of the courtroom. You know, I've always wanted to write a book. You know, I've been one of those people that, you know, you fantasize about certain things, you know, maybe being able to catch a touchdown in the Super Bowl, being able to write a book. And I figured that I was past my prime and wasn't going to be able to catch a touchdown in the Super Bowl. So it left writing a book. So I decided that that I wanted to do that for some time. Because of the busy schedule, you're like, you keep putting it off. You figure that at some point you'll get to it, but you never get around to getting to it. And so I just had to decide this is the time to do it and just go ahead and figure out how to get it done and how to find the time and just do it. So,
did you always want to write a legal thriller?
Yeah, you know, when you read, you know, like John Grisham and those type of authors, you know, you kind of see how they're writing, and in your mind, it's like being a Monday morning quarterback. It's like, oh, I could have written that better. The courtroom stuff could have been more realistic, or, you know, and so you start thinking, well, you know, I can do it, until you start getting into it and realize just how difficult it is. But I've always wanted to write a legal thriller, and I wanted to have it to be sexy too. And then I started writing it and started thinking about, well, what if, you know, my kids or other people are reading it, so you don't want to have anything in there that's too scandalous. So I made it more kid-friendly.
So tell us just briefly what the book is about and sort of how you incorporated your experience in Dallas and in the legal profession here into the book.
Sure. The book is about a lawyer who found himself in a family crisis because of his work schedule, how busy he was, that it caused a rift in his house, and so he was estranged from his wife and his family. And during this period of time, a girl goes missing who happens to have a relationship with his wife, and she asks him to try to find the missing girl. Unlike reality, where lawyers don't go out looking for missing people, and lawyers don't get involved in all of the investigatory aspects of law or anything else. I wanted to make sure that in this book that the lawyer was involved in all aspects, because you wanted him to be the one that was put in any type of peril or anything else that came about it. You want him to be the one that was involved in it. So it was really interesting to try to place a lawyer in a position of that a lawyer wouldn't normally be in. And so what I did was I figured, well, how best to create a book other than use your real life experiences. And so I had a case with Don Hill where I represented him. And when I started thinking about the book and creating the book was really going to be all about my experiences with the Don Hill trial. And I thought, man, you know, this would be really interesting. You got the paper bag behind a church and money changing hands and all the things that happened in the trial. And I thought this would be really interesting. But the more I started outlining, I started realizing that nobody would be interested in this except if you lived in Dallas. So I wanted to make it more of a national story. So I changed characters and wanted to be, instead of a city council person, a U.S. senator. And then after I started outlining, I started moving further and further away from anything dealing with that, and the story started taking a life of its own, as well as a case that I had with Kadrian Turner, who was taken from Houston to Columbia. So I had to go to Columbia and get her back. So that's where Columbia comes in the book. So the book takes place in Dallas, in D.C. area, and in Columbia. So I wanted to kind of intertwine some of those experiences into the book.
Were you ever afraid of, like, violating attorney-client privilege once you originally started writing? Because it was your case that you were initially basing it off of.
Yeah, that was going to be a problem unless I got permission from Mr. Hill or from Ms. Turner to talk about their case specifically. So that also led to me moving further and further away from anything that happened in those cases, other than utilizing the cases as a basis for creating the fictional story.
And the main character, Reese Ryan, he's your alter ego, so to speak, right?
Yeah, he's my alter ego. You know, we're pretty close in a lot of ways. You know, he's 6'2", and I'm, you know, 5'11".
He's a new and improved version of you.
Yeah, he's a new and improved version of me, and he's much smarter and has a much more successful law firm. But a lot of me is written in Therese because that's kind of what I know, and so I approached it. Where you're creating these characters, all the characters are created, and I'm creating these character arcs where I'm developing the characters' likes, dislikes, strengths, weaknesses, and everything about these characters. But for Reese, I didn't have to do it so much because it was really just saying, okay, here's me, and instead of putting all the bad stuff, you know, here's the best of me, and so I wanted it to be, I wanted him to be as close to me as possible so that I can keep it kind of realistic.
I think you need to tell us more about this bad stuff that you left out.
There's a lot of it. There's a lot of it. You know, I was just telling a friend of mine today, like, I hadn't lost a trial in several years, a criminal trial. And she was like, well, I want to sit in on trial with you. I said, well, I got a lot of bad habits. It works for me, but you may not want to example.
Speaking of habits, yeah. As all of us in the room are writers, we know, you know, how hard it is to write and make yourself sit down and write and to find the right words. How did you balance all of that with your practice? And do you have any tricks maybe you can help us and share, help us improve?
Well, yeah, learning not to sleep. That was the biggest part.
Is that something you can learn?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to teach myself. It was, for each chapter, it was about 20, 25 hours for me, and that's because I'm not a writer. For, you know, if you were writing a book, you know, a chapter may not take you quite as long, but now you take that with 75 hours of law practice, and then you take your time that you are being a father and any organizations that you're a part of, and finding those 25 hours in a week becomes very difficult because my goal was to do a chapter a week. And so 20, 25 hours really is just all sleep time. So I was averaging about 3 hours a night of sleep.
Living on coffee?
I don't drink coffee.
So Me neither. I need sleep though.
Yeah, well, I don't drink coffee, but I drink a lot of soda and eating candy. But the thing that confused me is that eating candy and drinking soda really didn't keep me up. It would make me sleepy, you know. So, but in my mind, I thought, well, if I snack on chocolate and I eat chocolate and I drink soda, then I'm going to stay up. But it didn't work. But the secret for me was finding time anywhere I can get it. So instead of taking lunches, I'd write during lunch. Instead of sleeping at night, I'd write at night. If I was sleepy and I had to go to sleep, I'd go to sleep for 3 hours, wake up, and then write all morning before I had to go to court. So,
well, lawyers often say that, you know, if you can tell a story, you can do a trial. And it's pretty similar to being a journalist, to being a writer.
Right.
It's all about telling stories. So it's sort of a nice way to use both skills in both ways.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things that's really interesting, because you get two things when you're a lawyer. The first thing is, and doctors get this too, you know, you introduce yourself. Hey, you know, what do you do for a living? I'm a lawyer. You're a lawyer. Okay, so I have a cousin or I have a friend. This is what happened. And they want some type of legal advice or your legal opinion. So the next thing that happens is they want to know or hear war stories, especially if you're a criminal trial lawyer, because criminal trials are always fascinating. They're always interesting, sometimes pretty bad, but always interesting for people who want to listen. And so I was always being asked to tell these stories about cases. What's the most interesting case you've had and the most gory or any murder case you've had? So you're always storytelling. So that kind of helps you a lot because that's what we do. In trials, we're hoping that juries are buying our story and we're giving them a story and we're telling it from beginning to end. So,
how have other attorneys been receiving the novel?
Yeah, it's been interesting because several of the attorneys at the courthouse have all bought the book, and the reviews have really been really positive, ranging from you know, they didn't even realize I can read to this is, wow, this is really good. And the one that I'm getting most is, I've always wanted to write a book. You know, because all attorneys want to write books, you know. We want to be like you guys. We just don't know how to write. I mean, our writing style is very elementary. and so it's and we learn to write in law school and we keep that writing style, you know, throughout our careers. But it's much different than writing a book or writing if you're a journalist. So everybody has been like, well, I've always wanted to write a book. I have all these stories. And you know, but they never find the time. So it was just something that I found the time to do. But they really thought it was really, really good book.
Well, word on the street is you have a book signing at the courthouse.
Yes, February 25th. And we're going to have it at the courthouse at noon. So we'll catch all the lawyers right when they're finishing their morning dockets. And hopefully the ones that don't have it yet, who are all telling me they're going to get it, will get it on that day. So I'm excited about it.
So what's next for Reese Ryan? You're already working on the second book. Can you give us any hints about what we can expect for the fictional Ray Jackson?
Yeah, I think in the next book, it's not going to be so much political. It'll be more courtroom drama without getting too involved in the courtroom where you're talking legalese and things of that nature, but more along the lines of maybe a John Grisham courtroom book where, you know, like A Time to Kill, where there's some court, but there's a lot of drama outside of the court. So we'll get to see Reese's courtroom skills. And so I want to be able to highlight that in the next book, because we'll get more away from backstory. And that's one of the things when you're trying to create a character that you want people to relate to, that they're going to like in additional books, then you have to do a lot of backstory because you want to get that out of the way so that they feel like he's relatable or they like him. And now in the next story, you'll see him be more cutthroat, more courtroom, more of the litigator. So that's where the next book is headed.
Well, Ray, thank you very much for joining us, and we hope that figure out a billable hours schedule next time for your publisher. But
yeah,
we appreciate you coming in, and you can look for the book. It's Lone Justice, that's right.
Yes.
And you can get it. Where can people buy your book?
You can buy it on Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com. And if you have an iPhone or a tablet or any type of Apple product, you can get it from the Apple store, or you can get it from my website at rayjacksonbooks.com.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing what comes next. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We'll end here in just a few moments with a new Hashing It Out by Mike Hashimoto, but that's it for the rest of us today. Thank you for listening, and don't forget that you can follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crime Cast. You can also like our page on Facebook and see all of our previous episodes there, and you can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again to our guest Ray Jackson and to Kevin Krause for calling in from Austin. Our producer and sound engineer today is Brian Elledge. For Jen Emily and Sarah Mervosh, I'm Tristan Hallman. We hope you stay safe out there. Now, we drop the mic.
Here's an idea. How about we criminalize one less thing? I speak of fantasy sports, fun for some, ignored by others. Either way, they don't hurt you. It's in the news in Texas because our Attorney General, Ken Paxton, offered a non-binding opinion that daily fantasy games, like those run by DraftKings, violate our state's laws against gambling. In short, you pay to create pretend lineups of real players and win money if yours do the best in real life. Paxton is probably correct in a strict reading of the law. I won't argue his interpretation. I will argue that a law that uses quote-unquote partial chance to define gambling is a law that needs revision. Even in the state that makes money off a lottery, that's pretty much total chance. What else involves partial chance? Investing in an oil well or mutual fund, or stocks and bonds, or actually owning a sports team and paying hundreds of millions of dollars to real athletes, or walking across the street. I've mostly given up on Texas having the good sense to tax me to gamble in a legal casino. I don't play daily fantasy sports, mostly because I lack the skill and time to do it well. And that's my choice, as it should be. Prove the harm, or please just leave it alone.